are listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. I'm Danielle Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, we look at the life of a ballet dancer. An autographical new book by Mirjenka Čechová reveals the hardships it involves. And then we'll map the history of Prague's famous concert hall, the Rudolfinum. We have a packed half hour, so it's over to Ian Willoughby and his guest.
Mirjenka Čechová is an internationally acclaimed performer, director and choreographer, known for combining dance and physical theatre. In her recently published autobiographical novel, Baletky, or Ballet Dancers, Čechová draws on her years as a preteen and teenage student at Prague's Dance Conservatory, detailing extreme physical demands and constant psychological pressure. Nevertheless, the 38-year-old says she didn't attend the book, which also paints a vivid portrait of 90s Prague as a kind of my ballet hell-style misery memoir. And when we spoke, I first asked her about some of the extreme things she'd been through as a young ballet student.
Ballet dance is a very specific discipline. It is like when you do a sport on very high level. You have to have certain physical disposition, you have to have mental disposition, and you have to go through certain discipline that differs based on the school where you study. And I think that in my case, I was studying dance conservatory in 90s in Prague. It was still not too long after the fall of Iron Curtain.
And your school, sorry, was based on the Russian system, is that right?
Yes, it was. There was many Russian teachers, and I would say that also the spirit of the school was very much similar to what used to be before. But at the same time, there were, of course, some more progressive teachers, but probably I was not too lucky for those ones. When you are a child, you don't understand certain things that are happening to you as extreme. So you are basically accepting whatever is happening to you. Extreme become extreme much later when you are maybe an adult and you are watching the situation from distance. Now, I think that probably the most challenging thing was this very strict rules in physical look, how dancers supposed to look, how is their weight, their visage, even physical proportions. Before entering the school, I had to go through special medical exams where all my fat was measured, my head was measured, my facial features were measured, if they are in the right proportion. I had to write a special questionnaire about the truth of weight of my parents.
But didn't they lie about their weight to help you get accepted? Is that the case?
Well, you know, at that time, my father was already, you know, in the age when men put some weight on. And we were basically afraid that this might be a reason that they will not accept me. So he put a little bit less weight for himself. And my mother put at least a little bit less height, because ballet dancers should not be too high, because when they stand on points, they would be much higher than their partners. So it's much better to be a little bit smaller. Then there is, of course, big pressure on how you look, even if you are in puberty. You should not have your body looking too much feminine, I would say. Our weight was controlled very regularly, every Monday morning or a few times a month.
What was going through your mind when you were standing in front of all your classmates being weighed and measured like that?
Of course, that you felt ashamed. I was pretty tall for being a ballet dancer. I have 172 centimeters. I was the highest from the whole class. And of course, because of that, I had one of the highest weight. And I didn't want that because I want to be accepted for certain classes like Dance with Partner. But if we were overcoming 50 kilos, then they were telling us, no, you can't attend because boys will not lift you. So this was very frustrating. But my weight was not very problematic. I was pretty thin all the time, also because I was scared of putting on some weight, and also because...
But also you did things to keep your weight down, like you smoked, you took laxatives.
Yeah, I think almost everyone in my class was controlling their weight a certain way, from not eating at all or being on special diets, or also undergoing already some health issues like anorexia or bulimia. It was pretty common in my time at this environment.
Reading your book, I found it, I don't know anything about ballet. I was quite shocked. And I was wondering, why are parents sending their kids into this kind of system? And is it because some people have this kind of, to my mind, old-fashioned kind of bourgeois idea of what a good middle-class girl should do?
In my case, it definitely was not this way, because my parents didn't want me to become a ballet dancer. I had very good grades and I had talent for many other things. Perhaps I would become either piano player or doctor, but I had a big pressure from my ballet teacher, who thought that I am a big talent, and she was really pushing me to do this professionally. And me, in the age of 10, I basically became almost obsessed with this idea. Of course, you don't know what it means, actually. You have only this romantic vision of, like, standing on the stage in Swan Lake and being a center of the attention and dancing this romantic dance with your partner. So despite the fact that my parents didn't want me to go there, I really was fighting for my dream, and they eventually decided that, okay, we will try, and if you would not feel well there, you can always return. And definitely they didn't know anything from what was happening at school, because I knew that if they would know 1% of that, they would definitely put me out from the school. They will try to save me.
But that must cause a lot of pressure for especially a young teenager to have to hide their real life from their parents.
I was not living with my parents because they had to send me to Prague, to the capital that was almost 300 kilometers far from my own home. I was living in dormitory with other small girls. My parents saw me only during weekends, sometimes twice a month. And for me, it was a big adventure. At the time, I didn't see any danger. I didn't see anything bad on really going through very problematic and difficult situations, because I was following my dream, and it was a drug. Ballet was a drug. I was very good student. I was super excited, and I was able to do everything in order to succeed.
You write about the fact that almost all of your classmates didn't stay in ballet, and there was a very high turnover rate. People came, people were thrown out, new people came, they left. Given that the chances of success seem so small, and given that it can have a lasting effect on your body, is it a good kind of bet to try to be a ballet dancer?
Well, I can't generalize this, because everyone probably has different reasons. I think if you have a super great physical dispositions, which means a special way how your legs look, what's the length of your limbs, how open are your hips, all of these things matter in ballet. And if you have all of those physical features, plus you have the special mindset and big discipline in yourself, plus some luck, this is a cocktail when you can succeed. But my personality was probably, for me, really forming the decision during my studies and finding pretty problematic how we were mentally treated. And my craving for creativity, good education, plus certain freedom was things that slowly led me to decision that probably I should try another career, which came much later, but that was slowly forming during the studies, as I was finding out that maybe being unified under this physical technique full of rules is not the way I want to succeed in my life.
You're quite a few years younger than I am, but I think it's very possible we were in some of the same places in the 1990s. For example, you write about the club Roxy or the pub La Casa Blu. And the book, as much as anything else, or on top of everything else, it's also a kind of memoir of Prague in the 90s. What are your standout memories of that period?
Well, for me, this is actually why I've decided to write the book, because 90s was for me the main topic. But of course, the ballet came by hand by this, because it was my path. But I remember the atmosphere as something that was in very strong opposite, almost in a contradictory to this discipline I was going through. So it was very, very freeing. And for us, it was a time when, for example, house music started, this electronic music was taking over, and with clubbing, there was also drugs at this scene, there was certain anarchy that was happening, there was certain fight towards authorities that were still, some of them, part of the previous system. So the spirit in Prague in 90s was this wild child in puberty that was really our age. So in the book, I am using this as like almost a mirror to the ballet discipline, this free spirit of the time in a contrast with very unfree spirit in the school.
Also, I guess just simply dancing in a club like Roxy or Radost must have been just a total release to you, because there were no rules.
Yeah, exactly. It was moments when you could really release certain pressure in yourself, when you could dance without being judged all the time. You could dance without watching yourself in the mirror. And the parties were about like really losing your head and dancing, because you want to dance, you want to release yourself in this collective feeling, and you want to be who you are. So I think it was one of the ways that helped us to a little bit get back to our own feet.
Also, you must have been all incredible dancers.
Well, probably not in the way as the house music would suggest. Or I think we were probably these weird girls dancing weird movements among other people. But no one was actually like judging us, though we were really enjoying to do something that was like somehow against the rules, you know.
The second last line of the book includes the words, "I received the Best of Contemporary Dance Award from the Washington Post." You've had fantastic success in your career internationally. How much of that do you credit to your ballet upbringing?
Well, when I finished the conservatory, I've decided I'll never dance anymore, because there was this certain disillusion of, in general, dance environment, because I didn't know anything else except classical ballet. Plus, I really wanted to study and to develop myself more in the intellectual way, because I felt that the body is something that in a certain moment will stop, have its value, because dancers have very short career, and I mean classical dancers. And then there is this big gorge gap of like unknown things. But slowly, while I was studying at two universities at the same time, which was the result of my crazy discipline, I was finding my way to dance again. But it was not a ballet anymore, but it was more physical theater. It was dance theater, and also, at the end, contemporary dance that was, at that time, for me, in big contrast to what I was experiencing at school. A really creative environment full of people with strong creative potential discussing burning topics of our society. It was a very vivid community that was engaged socially, artistically, and where I was finding my voice pretty strongly, and I found out that I want to be a creator, not an interpret.
But would you be able to do those things if you didn't have the ballet foundations?
Probably I would, but, well, I would have to go through probably different school, maybe school of contemporary dance. But what ballet gave me definitely was physical technique that allows me to do things physically pretty easily, but I had to really get rid of certain stereotypes and certain tension in the body that took me many years to release, because everyone could see that I'm a ballet dancer. I was walking a certain way, I was carrying my body a certain way. So to release all the tension, to release tension in my spine and neck, it took me really some time. So it was not so easy to immediately. But what also ballet gave me was a certain struggle that I consider to be very helpful for artists, that is something like a creative wound you have in your body, in your soul, and that I am not indifferent to certain things. I am super sensitive to my freedom. I am super sensitive to the power. And it brought definitely awareness to the topics that if I would not go through, I would not be able to understand them. So I say this hypersensitivity that I have is on one hand very problematic, but on the other hand, I feel blissful, because it's this creative potential that is within myself.
Mirjenka Čechová speaking there to Ian Willoughby about the life of a ballet dancer. You are tuned to Radio Prague International, and the culture buffs among you will be pleased to hear that we are now staying in the world of culture. Those of you who have been to Prague are likely to have visited the concert hall known as the Rudolfinum. Ruth Frankova will now fill you in on its history and how it got its name.
A new book published by the Czech Philharmonic in collaboration with the National Heritage Institute and the National Technical Museum pays tribute to one of Prague's most beautiful landmarks, the Rudolfinum Concert Hall. On the space of 500 pages, it maps the history of the building from the first construction plans to the early 1990s. The book, called Temple of Art Rudolfinum, also features over 270 historical photos, drawings, plans and posters. The neo-Renaissance building of the Rudolfinum, one of the oldest concert halls in Europe, was designed by the architects of the National Theatre, Josef Schulz and Josef Zitek. It was named after the Austrian Crown Prince Rudolf, and it was opened to the public on the 7th of February 1885. The building has been used as a concert venue by the Czech Philharmonic since the orchestra's foundation in 1896, but it is also home to one of Prague's leading art galleries. Lukáš Duchek, head of the Investment and Administration Department of the Rudolfinum, spoke to Czech Radio about the newly released book dedicated to the famous landmark. He first explained how the Rudolfinum came to be built in the so-called Rejiště.
V Rudolfinu v současnosti sídlí Česká se v naší knize věnuje urbanistickým dějinám území.
In the 1870s, the place called Rejiště, with its chemical plants and timber warehouses, was located on the outskirts of the old town. Since the 1870s, urban plans proposing changes to the area started to emerge. One of their authors was the architect Josef Zitek. As the first building in the area, Rudolfinum set the direction for its future development. The place gradually turned into an island of art and education. It accommodated the buildings of the Museum of Decorative Arts, Charles University's Philosophical and Law Faculties, and the Academy Gymnasium, today the seat of the Prague Conservatory, as well as the building of the Academy of Arts, Architecture and Design.
One of the authors of the book, art historian Richard Beagle, says that the setting of the Rudolfinum is unique in itself. The building, with a monumental backdrop of Letná Park and a spectacular view of Prague Castle, is located on the right bank of the Vltava River, at a place where all of the old town's main streets come together. Here is an extract of his text.
The urban value of the place and its key role in the city is obvious today, but at the time when the idea to build the Rudolfinum originated, the situation was quite different. Radiště, as the place is called, used to be a sort of inner periphery. Low houses, fences, and other buildings grew from the uneven surface of the riverbank, which served to store timber, saltpeter, and for other agricultural purposes. The character of the periphery was also enhanced by the vicinity of the Jewish ghetto, which was an organism of its own within the old town, with its vast Jewish cemetery.
The construction of the multipurpose building dedicated to music and visual arts was initiated by the savings bank Böhmische Sparkasse, the oldest financial institution in Bohemia. The authors selected in an international competition were two very important architects from Prague, Josef Zítek and Josef Schulz. Both of them were professors of Prague Technical University and former students of a famous school of architecture, the Academy of Arts in Vienna. They were also responsible for many other important buildings in Prague, including the National Theatre. Lukáš Duchek again.
Už v prosinci roku 1874 se na vlastní náklady vydali na studijní cestu.
In December 1874, they set out on a working trip to Germany, France, Belgium and the United Kingdom to see famous concert halls and galleries and meet some of the leading European architects and other experts. Their main advisor over acoustics was the German composer Richard Wagner, although, as you can read in the book, his advice wasn't always the best. Construction of the Rudolfinum Concert Hall began in June 1876, but it was delayed from the start due to the rising level of the Vltava River. In the end, the construction process took 8 years instead of the planned 4, and the final budget increased from 500,000 to 2 million guldens. Building was approved in 1884.
The Rudolfinum building consists of two interconnected parts. One is the famous Dvořák Concert Hall, now housing the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra. The other part of the building, today's Rudolfinum Gallery, is used as a space for art exhibitions. The building was decorated mainly by the artists of the so-called National Theatre generation, such as František Ženíšek, Bohuslav Šnirch and others. Lukáš Duchek continues.
Hlavním autorem výzdoby interiéru je Pietro Isella, proslulý producent.
The main author of the interior decoration was Pietro Isella, a respected ornamental author of the era. His work focused on the ceiling in the main concert hall and the staircase, which leads to the exhibition space. The decoration of the exteriors was entrusted to Josef Fanta and Zelda Klocek. The most important exterior decorations include the female statues at the entrance, symbolizing church and secular music, the sphinxes at the gallery entrance, and the two lions at the carriage entrance, designed by Antonín Wagner and Bohuslav Schrnich.
Jejichž autory jsou Antonín Wagner a Bohuslav Schnirch.
The opening ceremony took place on the 7th of February 1885 with a concert featuring Ludwig van Beethoven's overture The Consecration of the House. From that moment until 1918, Rudolfinum served as the city's new temple of art, accommodating various cultural institutions including galleries. However, as their collections grew in size, they were forced to look for a space of their own, writes art historian Roman Prahl.
The Nationalized Academy of Arts moved to a new building at Letná, and the Museum of Applied Arts also acquired a venue of its own. Later, the Academic Gymnasium and university buildings were built along the river. So the building's lack of space turned out to be an advantage for the development of the nearby district. Thanks to the initial contribution of the Rudolfinum, the plans for creating Prague's island of arts and culture materialized.
The book Temple of Art, Rudolfinum, also describes in detail how the newly established Czechoslovak government decided to turn the monumental building into a provisional seat of the parliament, says Lukáš Duchek.
Státní správa zabrala Rudolfinum 1. září 1919.
In September 1919, the state administration took over the Rudolfinum. Soon, its renovation was launched. The building was interconnected with the neighboring academic gymnasium, which was also taken over by the parliament. The auditorium and the concert hall were rebuilt to serve as the House of Parliament, and the stage was turned into a grandstand. The first session took place there on May 26th,
1920.
Although the use of Rudolfinum as a seat of the parliament was regarded as a provisional solution, construction of a new parliamentary seat was delayed and the temporary arrangement turned into a permanent one. That is, until the outbreak of the Second World War, when the Nazis once again turned the building into a concert hall. Here is an extract from the book written by historian Michal Novotný.
There were several reasons why the Nazis decided to rebuild the Rudolfinum again. One of them was the symbolic cleansing of an originally German building, which was, in their eyes, degraded by serving the Czechoslovak Republic. The neo-Renaissance style of the Rudolfinum also appealed to the Nazis. Another reason was that the German orchestra in Prague didn't have their own concert hall.
After the renovation and modernization, Rudolfinum was ceremoniously opened to the public on the 16th of October 1941 in the presence of the Nazi governor of occupied Bohemia and Moravia, Reinhard Heydrich. It took place on the same day that the first transport of around 50,000 Prague Jews was sent from the city's Bubny station to the extermination camps in the east. After the war, Rudolfinum became the seat of the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, as well as the Prague Conservatory and the Academy of Music. In 1946, it hosted the first ever concert of the Prague Spring Festival. Following the fall of the communist regime, Rudolfinum underwent a complete renovation led by architect Karel Prager, which included the re-establishment of the gallery. The building opened to the public on the 14th of May 1992 and has since served its original purpose.
The history of the Rudolfinum Concert Hall, courtesy of Ruth Frankova, and check out the pictures at radio.cz. And remember, make sure that you pay it a visit when you next come to Prague. I'm afraid that's all from us for today. You'll find us at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then the address to write to is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for listening and take care.